She is on Panel 1, World Service Delegate, and Panel 10, Trustee for the Western United States. I give you Arbutus O.M. from Brownwood, Texas.
Not going to catch me hopping up on that platform. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family groups. I am powerless over people, places, and things. And because of this program, I can make this admission now without feeling guilty. My life is unmanageable. Without the daily practice of the principles of a program that was given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to believe that the families of the early AA members were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups, and more recently the Alateen groups, grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the principle that alcoholism is a family illness. And I'm afraid that we sometimes get so carried away telling people how sick we got that we forget to tell them that we have a program for family recovery. That's why I think these weekend get-togethers are so very important. These rallies, roundups, conventions, whatever you want to call them. When we get together on the weekend, we present to the world a showcase of recovery. Anyone who comes into these sessions can see a whole family getting well while they're having a marvelous time. And that's why I'm so very grateful to be a part of your weekend celebration. I've been in West Virginia before. I spent some much happy times here and some very sad times. And I'm grateful to be back again. If you want to get rich, you can just take that plot of grass that's right out in front of this building to any spot in Texas, and they'll pay you a large price for it, believe me. It's tremendous. It's been my privilege and great pleasure to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups. And that doesn't mean very much unless you're a long-timer. And I can tell you how to get to be a long-timer. Just keep coming to meetings and stay alive. I used to feel that alcoholism is a product of my generation, and why shouldn't I? We got blamed for everything else. But this isn't true. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive illness that can cause the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is an insidious public cancer that can cause a man or a woman to turn against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. And Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I have been able to learn, seemed to be able to do anything about alcoholism before this generation. Priests and ministers were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady, if you please. They preached to the alcoholic. They prayed over him. They had him sign pledges. And when these things failed, they damned his soul to hell. Men of science in other generations wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the medical students before our lifetime, "Don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless." Preachment failed, and there was no cure. So there was only one other thing they knew to do with the alcoholic. He must be punished. So we locked you up in jails. The more you drank, the longer we kept you in jail. And the longer we kept you in jail, the drunker you got when you were released. It became a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. I'm quite sure that we'll never know how many sick alcoholics died in the jails around our country at the hands of sadistic jailers. We'll never know. But there was one group of people who never quite gave up on the alcoholic. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot checks. We bailed you out of jails. We pled with judges. We said, "John's a good man when he's sober." And to complete this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. And people, society in general, were completely and utterly puzzled by the behavior of the families of alcoholics. They did not know what to do with us. They didn't understand us at all. Now, they could understand an alcoholic that got drunk and fell down in public places and had to be put in jail, but they couldn't understand us. We were a far bigger puzzlement than the alcoholic ever thought about being. There were some people, of course, that thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us continue to love and care for the alcoholics, and they gave us nice, shiny halos to wear. They almost killed us with their pity, and we don't need pity, we need understanding. And we accepted these halos quite willingly. I put mine on every morning when I put on my lipstick. And my halo had a name. It was called a self-righteousness. You know, I've said this a lot of times, and here not too long ago, I discovered something. That word doesn't even taste good. It really doesn't. Self-righteousness doesn't even taste good. But that was the name of my halo. I had an AA member tell me one time, "The halo slips sticks and she'll choke you to death." And then there were other people, of course, that thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. She used to say, "God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of our Butis and Bill." And Mother was right. God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then a little farther down the line, we got the professionals into the picture. Let's not forget the professionals. They were the ones who put the labels on us. Aggravating influences, we were called. Disturbing factors. And then it got real corny. Suffering Susies. Wavering Winifreds. And faltering Francis. They felt that those of us who love alcoholic were masochistic. Now, that's a 12-cylinder word that means that we like to suffer. And I suppose that some of these people may have been right. I strongly feel that it would depend on which side you were on. I was privileged to serve on the faculty of the University of Utah one summer at their Utah School on Alcoholic Studies, and we were overrun with these charming people. But they made a slight mistake. I had mic time last, and I was able to ask them a question that I consider quite pertinent. And I asked them, what would you do? What would you do if you watched the person you loved most in all the world consistently and persistently kill themselves? What would you do? Would you cry in the night if you had the gift of tears left? Would you maybe whimper a little bit? You see, what we did, those of us who love alcoholics, we tried to solve a problem that completely and totally baffled the finest minds in our country. By their own admission, the clergy could not cope with these things. The legal profession could not. The medical profession could not. There was no laws or legislation that would solve this problem, but we tried to solve it. And the only thing we had going for us was the fact that we loved these people. And we did not know that love was not enough. I hope you understand that I don't like labels. I just don't like labels. It's very difficult to help people, I found, even people who want help. But if you have to scratch a label off of them before you can get through to the real person, it makes your job twice as hard. So let's don't put labels on people. And then there was another very significant fact, I think, that puzzled society. Now, every one of us in this room knows what an alcoholic is. We've been told quite often what an alcoholic is. They're sorry, no account, lazy, stupid, dirty people. Now, we know that. They told us so. But then society discovered that some very brilliant, talented people were alcoholic. And this didn't fit the pattern. And I did a little research on this, and I learned that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He had conquered the whole known civilized world when he was only 33 years old. And he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he could not conquer his desire to drink. And he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. He gave the world its most beautiful folk music. And they found Stephen Foster on the New York Bowery, sickened to death. And when he was dead, they found in his pockets 38 cents. One penny for each year of a misspent life, and the lyrics to another song. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his Jeannie with the light brown hair. But the love of his wife could not stop him from drinking, and he died drunk. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories. And he describes the personality change of an alcoholic in the story Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The magic that he found in the bottle was the thing that destroyed him. It could have been a fifth of gin or a quart of bourbon. And in the personality change that he describes in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I saw this personality change repeat itself over and over and over again right in my own living room. Some of you out there saw it too. You saw the bottle change the man you love into a babbling idiot, into a degenerate animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, the history books tell us very little about the families of these men and others like them, but I believe that I know the loneliness and the fear that Jeannie knew. when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from one of his sprees. It used to come on him like a sickness, she said, and so it does. And I knew the fear and the loneliness that Jeannie knew. And I knew the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He also had tuberculosis. And I believe that I know the joy that they knew when he did regain his health. And I believe that I know the serenity that they both knew when he found sobriety. And people say to me, why do you feel it necessary to give us a history lesson every time you stand up behind one of those podiums, Arbutus? Well, the truth of the matter is, I cannot tell a joke. I always forget the punchline. Always forget the punchline. So I give you a history lesson. But the point of the history lesson is this, is to point out the fact that these self-same people who were so hopelessly inadequate to solve the problem of alcoholism in other generations are doing quite wonderful jobs now in our lifetime. Priests and ministers now feel that alcoholics are God's children too, and they send them to treatment so they can get well. And they send their families to us so they can get well too. It's now possible to get a man in a hospital with the simple diagnosis of alcoholism. This was not true only a few years ago. At least it was not true in the state of Texas. You couldn't get a man in the hospital unless the doctor was willing to falsify the diagnosis and say that he had something else. It was impossible. County judges now send alcoholics for treatment instead of sending them to jail. And we have fabulous rehabilitation programs in our federal penitentiaries under the auspices of AA. National Council on Alcoholism and other agencies are doing a tremendous job removing the stigma from the disease of alcoholism. It's almost impossible to pick up a magazine or a newspaper anymore and fail to find an article on alcoholism. It's become the in thing to have an alcoholic in your family. Now, if you don't have one of your own, why just go out and borrow one? Now, a few years back, I'd have been willing to give you two or three. But with all of the good work and with all of the thousands and thousands of government dollars that are being pushed into the rehabilitation programs and the treatment centers for alcoholism across our country, I have to report to you here this evening that they're not getting the job done. They're just not getting the job done. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I have tremendous respect for our friends in the professions. I have tremendous respect for their training and for their good intentions. But they are not getting the job done for the simple fact that they don't understand all there is to know about alcoholism. But when I look out at a group of people like we have here this evening, I know that I'm looking at a room full of experts. You're the people who know about alcoholism. You know about alcoholism because you've lived with it. You know the symptoms of alcoholism. You know the progression. You know about slips in AA. You know about the alibi system. You know about alcoholic convulsions. Some of you, bless your heart, know the terrors of DTs. There isn't very much about alcoholism that you do not know because you've lived with it. So it is my opinion that you are the ones who can solve this problem. This is a job for you to do, a job for you and for me. And I learned this a long time ago. You see, I came into this outfit before we had an outfit. When I came here, there were 50 groups, Al-Anon groups. Well, I came here a little before that. But when Al-Anon started, there were 50 groups in the whole world. That's all. And now our delegates report that we have upward of 25,000 groups reaching all over the world. Our literature is translated into many different languages. You heard a speaker last night that found Al-Anon in Tokyo. And I gloried in the fact that we had literature that was translated into Japanese. That wasn't true when I came here. When I came here, we didn't have any literature at all, not one single piece. All we actually had in those early days was the growing awareness of a great need and the dubious permission of some people who were very new in AA to come to their clubhouses while they had a meeting. And that's what we did. We met in little alcoves and dirty little kitchens around the country, and we talked. Now, I'm not going to have to tell you what we talked about. It was a kind of a morbid competition to see which one of us lived with the sorriest man. Now, that's what it was. As you heard Bill say this afternoon, I was not very comfortable in those meetings for the simple fact that I did not live with a sorry man. I have never lived with a sorry man. I lived with a fine young man who drank too much. And to be sure, those early meetings were not very constructive. But I have to remind my Al-Anon friends that if we had not been there then, you would not be here now. Since we had no literature, I often say that Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention because they were both born of necessity. And the dear people who put the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous together knew that in time we would become aware of this necessity, and so they made provisions for us. When they wrote the book Alcoholics Anonymous, they included in that book two chapters for the families of alcoholics. One of these chapters was entitled To the Wives. Now, that was not intended to be a put-down to the fine men that we have in the Al-Anon family groups. But the truth of the matter is, when that book was written, there were no women in AA. So they simply addressed that chapter to the wives. The early groups in Canada called their groups the wives' groups. And the other chapter is entitled, To the Family Afterward. Now, down in my part of the country, we took a paragraph from this chapter, and we made of it a little preamble that we used to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family that has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Cling to the thought that your dark past, that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. Now, I may not be totally accurate at this point, but I believe that we have in the neighborhood of 100 pieces of literature at this point, 100 pamphlets or so. We have 9 hardback books. And as far as I'm concerned, we do not have one single piece of literature that more clearly points out to me what my responsibility is to the families of alcoholics. Nor do we have one single piece of literature that more clearly points out to me how I can show my gratitude for the sobriety in our home and for the good things that sobriety has brought to us. This paragraph has literally caused me to travel thousands upon thousands of miles. It has caused me to be active in Al-Anon ever since we've had a fellowship. Now, it is not popular in some sections of the country anymore to read literature written by Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm aware of that. Under no circumstances should you bring the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, into your Al-Anon meeting. It's no... Well, now, ain't that too bad? Now listen to me very carefully if you're going to make a report to the World Service Office. I require anyone I sponsor to study the first 164 pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous in order that they may learn the philosophy of the fellowship that is going to change their life, in order that they may learn the nature of their illness and what can be done to arrest that illness and why they reacted in such an unhealthy way. And it makes sense to me. If you're going to understand the illness of alcoholism, why shouldn't you read the world's foremost authority on the illness, which is the book, Alcoholics Anonymous? And when someone I sponsor has completed this assignment, I suggest that they get a copy of the AA, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, and get to work. And the only criterion that I have for this procedure is that the people I sponsor get well. And my track record's pretty good. As I say, we don't use the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, very much in Al-Anon meetings anymore, except in West Texas. We keep it in our lending library. We consider it required reading. We say in Al-Anon, we share with you our experience, strength, and hope. And that's what Jane asked me to come up here and do. And how she found me is a total puzzlement to me. I haven't lived in Wichita Falls in almost 6 years. And somehow she got the name of a member in Wichita Falls that is not one of my greatest admirers. And Paula told her where, gave her my phone number. And it just delighted me. I didn't think Paula cared where I lived anymore. Now, Paula's a pretty little girl. She looks like a Barbie doll, and I think that's the reason I get mad at her. I never saw a hair out of place on that female's head. You just want to hit her. She's a real little beauty for sure, and that man named Joe loves her very much. But Jane heard me talk, she said, in Durham, North Carolina. Well, I remember that weekend. I picked up a cold on the way to the mountains and got into that piney woods and my lungs opened up and I got pneumonia before I got back to Texas. In fact, when Jane heard me talk, I was running a fever of 104. And when Bill got up that morning, they put us in a room with twin beds, which Bill's against. But I knew I was burning up and I'd had pneumonia a number of times. I knew the symptoms. So I pulled a blanket up over my head and pretended I was asleep and Bill got out without seeing how hot I was. And the only thing I had going for me that afternoon was the fact that every one of the people in that group had two heads. Every one of them. But Dr. John Moody was sitting on the front row, and I knew if I pitched on my face, he'd be there to pick up the pieces. I don't know how she could have listened to that talk, because I coughed more than anything else. And I'd like a drink of water. My throat's dry at the moment. But I'm grateful that Jane did take the trouble that she did this. To ask me to come up here, and it was a marvelous trip, and I'll try to do exactly what she asked me to do. I will share with you my experience, strength, and hope in love. I attended my first AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948, and I did not want to go to that meeting. As Bill told you this afternoon, he'd learned about AA in Fort Worth, Texas in 1945, but he was not able to stay sober. And I didn't have very much confidence in Bill's sobriety. But I went to the meeting for the very simple reason that I had put myself under an obligation to a nice little lady who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, honey. And you've discovered by now that I'm a hillbilly. And hillbillies don't like to be obliged. So I went to the meeting very reluctantly. It was an open meeting of the kind I like. And I expect there was about 100 people there, and I drink a lot of coffee, and I'm sure I'd been to the coffee bar a number of times when we were seated in the meeting. And a very lovely lady that I learned later was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous leaned across my friend Marguerite, and she whispered to me. And what she said was, "How long has it been since you had a drink, honey?" And I wasn't embarrassed with her question. I'm not a teetotaler. I used to say I didn't trust teetotalers. But I have a friend down in Texas who's never tasted whiskey in her life. She's a real teetotaler. And I would trust her with my life. So I don't say that anymore. But Marguerite was embarrassed to death, and she answered the lady's question. She said, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism." You see, I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My dad was a two-fisted construction man who worked hard. He played hard, and he drank hard. My dad was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry, who taught me to sing Irish folk songs. But on Saturday night, my daddy turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both my parents. My father's alcoholism turned my mother into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated my father. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead and in his grave. And in the last 4 years of her life, which she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin, and that included me. Dad was one of those people who couldn't make this program. He used to come to Texas, and he'd go to AA meetings with us. And we'd come home from the meetings, and he'd always ask us the same question. "How do you get the want to?" he'd say. Dad couldn't find the want to, and he couldn't stay sober. And for many years after I found the courage in this program to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I closed every single day of my life with one special prayer. "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Now, I cannot tell you why this is such a terror to those of us who love alcoholics. I can only tell you that it is. God, don't let my dad die drunk. My father died in Charleston, West Virginia in 1965. He did not die drunk. He died of throat cancer. We were living in Austin at that time, and my brother Mike, who's 9 years younger than I, called me when they diagnosed Dad as having terminal cancer. And he said, "Sis, we've got to play extra hard for Dad. He's not going to make it." And I said, "No, no." You see, God answered my prayer. Now, you know that I didn't want that filthy stuff to destroy that beautiful baritone voice. You know I didn't want that filthy stuff to tear out John Martin's throat. You know I didn't. I prayed, "God, don't let my dad die drunk." I do not tell you these things about my dad or about my mother that you may weep for them. And I wish I could do it, what's the word, objectively. I just can't. You see, that's what got me in trouble in the first place. I'm quite sure that if this had been a thinking problem, I wouldn't have had any trouble, because I'm smarter than all get out. But my feelings got mixed up in it, and my feelings get mixed up in my story. I know you will forgive me. I tell you these things about my dad and my mother to let you know that I have always loved an alcoholic, and I want to report to you that my dad and my mother are quite all right. You see, my dad doesn't have to drink anymore, and mother doesn't hate him any longer. But I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love alcoholics, I want to restore their family. Because I am convinced that of all the things an alcoholic loves, he loves his family most. Of this I'm convinced. He loves his family most. Even when he tears us down over and over and over again, he loves his family most. Now I want you to know too that when I married that tall Texan that you all enjoyed so much this afternoon, I wasn't concerned with Bill's drinking. Not a bit in this world. Father Joe Martin says the only way that you can, that the only parallel of comparison that you have with an alcoholic is with the one that you know. And Bill didn't drink like Dad. Dad was a hallucinating drunk who saw creeping, crawling things. And I'm quite sure that my mother couldn't quite understand when her jaw was broken that he'd only intended to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. I'm not sure I could have understood that. But I wasn't concerned with Bill's drinking. Law, Bill had a lot of fun. He crashed a debutante's party in Philadelphia one time and taught the do-waggers to put your little foot, and they just loved him. And they didn't have to go home with him that night and see those horrendous hangovers that he described this afternoon. They didn't see that part. But I wasn't concerned. I drank with Bill, and as he told you this afternoon, we traveled all over the United States, and we got drunk everywhere we've been. I'm quite sure we were never in Jackson Mill, and we'd been drunk here. But we got drunk in San Antonio, Chicago, St. Louis, anywhere we went. And it seemed to be exceedingly important in my generation that people have fun. I heard an AA lady say she had so much fun it almost killed her. And that's what happened to Bill and me. But in 1940, two things happened that should have made us grow up. We became parents, and the world became involved in a war. And I quit drinking with Bill. It was that simple. Things were too serious. My brothers were in service. Members of his family were. I was watching casualty lists. I wasn't drinking with Bill anymore. We had our second child the next year, and Bill wasn't there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday, and she didn't meet her dad till Sunday. Nancy was born in a Catholic hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio. And when Bill came to the hospital with the usual paraphernalia that you men bring to us when we're in delivery rooms, he caused a great deal of confusion in that hospital. Because he wanted to teach the Catholic nun in charge of the maternity ward the Texas stomp, and the good sister did not want to dance. And two big burly orderlies helped him out of the hospital. He sat down on the streetcar track in plain view of my window, forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. We had our only son the next year, and I couldn't talk about this for a long time because I manipulated that pregnancy. I knew that my Bill wanted a son. I guess every man does. Something went wrong in that delivery room, and they needed Bill. And they couldn't find Bill. Now, had I been able to talk to them, I could have told them that they would find Bill in a bar. But you see, I didn't know which one. And my friends in AA tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of time. But I believe that I know about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife. When she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion, this, I believe, is loneliness. The lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive or any other holiday for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. This, I believe, is loneliness. and the crawling fingers of loneliness that you feel when you wait by the hospital bed of an injured child who cries for her daddy. And you can't find her daddy. I want my daddy. This, I believe, is loneliness. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. This little guy of ours, a little Polish doctor, put him in my lap when I was seated in a wheelchair and I was going to bring him home. She put him in my lap and she said, take him home and enjoy him, Mrs. O'Neill. You can't keep him. They told us that our son would never walk. And the overwhelming guilt that I felt when I got this information was something that I would not even attempt to describe to you. My Bill wanted a son, and I gave him a son who couldn't walk. I devoted myself for the next many months to total concentration on that boy. I was determined that he would walk. And at that point in my life, I had nothing to pray to. The only hope that I had that that boy would ever take a step was in medical doctors. And I went to one crippled children's clinic after another. Anybody who might help my son to walk. 3 months after Luther was born, I discovered I was pregnant again. Teresa is one of those lovely people who thrives on loving neglect, and that's very fortunate because that's all she got. Bill was having personality clashes with the people that he worked for, and they transferred us to Knoxville, Tennessee, out of the Cincinnati office that he told you about this afternoon. And we went down there just about the time that they brought that atomic energy plant, and he had leased us a house, a nice three-bedroom house out on Coulter Avenue on the top of a hill, or a furnished house, if you please, that cost us $50 a month. Now this boy was making $600 or $700 a week in legitimate commissions. And remember, this was right in the big middle of the war. And if you need the furnace real bad, he wasn't a bit unwilling to take a little payola under the counter. But we were evicted from a furnished house that cost $50 a month for non-payment of rent. And this was not the last of the eviction notices that I was to see. And then I became familiar with another fine agency called Welfare. I'm not quite sure that my friends in Texas appreciate this part of my story, but I think you hillbillies will. You know, we don't like charity. But you'll take it. Don't think you won't. You'll go to a welfare agency to get food for your children and treatment for your young son. Don't you think you won't? I weighed about 107 pounds in those days because I couldn't swallow that food that was paid for from a little slip of paper that came from the welfare agency. I couldn't swallow it. It choked me to death. But I had to feed my children. And I saw the social work, the look of disgust on the social worker's face when she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters as if I couldn't read, "Husband is a drunkard." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. When I came to Texas, 40 years ago it's been now, in 1944, I resigned my school at midterm and went to Texas.
Turn tape over, please.
To follow Bill. I didn't have any trouble with the second step because I took four small children across the continent on the promise of an alcoholic that he'd never take another drink. And I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time had I ever heard this term. Bill explained to you this afternoon about his eye. He lost his left eye as a result of drinking, and he couldn't stop drinking. He lost his left arm as a result of drinking, and he couldn't stop drinking. And I watched this happen. He lost everything he had that he wanted to keep, including his self-respect and the affection of his own family, and he could not stop drinking. And I watched this happen, and I could do nothing to help him. And I wanted to. With every fiber of my being, I wanted to help Bill. But I couldn't help Bill. And I would never deliberately say anything from behind one of these podiums to help an alcoholic, to hurt an alcoholic. God knows you've been hurt enough. But I want to say something directly to you at this point. I've heard AA speakers stand at podiums around this country and have the unmitigated gall and the asinine arrogance to say a non-alcoholic don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I know what I'm talking about. I've had my own father beat me black and blue, killing spiders that only he could see. And my father loved me. I was his firstborn. He gave me this ridiculous name. He's the only human being that ever totally approved of me. He thought I was the smartest thing that ever came out of the hills of North Carolina. My father loved me, and yet he beat me black and blue, killing spiders that only he could see. And I've worked with alcoholic women until my hair and my skin reeked with the odor of formaldehyde. This is the treatment that they used to impose on people who were trying to get sober. And I go on record as saying there's nothing in the world as odious and nauseous as formaldehyde. And I've gone home, grateful in the knowledge that, but for the grace of God, someone might be walking me up and down and feeding me black coffee to send my own children to school. I know what I'm talking about. We wanted to help you, but you would not let us. Now, the feeling that I'm trying to describe, this hopeless, helpless feeling that those of us who love alcoholics live with, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after miserable year, it never leaves us, this totally helpless, hopeless feeling. There's nothing on earth that parallels this feeling, nothing. It's the feeling that those of you who are parents have when you tend a sick child. The baby's sick, burning up with fever, and it cries, and you want to help the baby, but you can't help the baby because the baby can't tell you where it hurts, and the alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt, and we could not help them. But there's some of you here this evening who are alive because of somebody like me. And please, the next time that you want to indict the families of alcoholics, will you please remember that we wanted to help you, but that you wouldn't let us. You wouldn't let us. And I wanted to help Bill, and I couldn't help Bill. And then, this unholy compulsion that totally and completely demoralized both of us made it possible that we start what I call a new kind of education. And in the pursuit of this education, we met some people. Now, the first group of these people that we met were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never shall forget the first AA member that ever talked to me. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon, and he described to me what I referred to then as this rehabilitation program for alcoholics. I didn't know anything else to call it. And after about 2.5 hours, I asked him a question. I said, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics?" And nobody ever asked him that question before because he couldn't answer it. And he said to me, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem. You do not have a problem." Dear Lord, I couldn't wear sleeves at that time because of a rash that covered both my arms. The doctor said it was caused by nerves. I was so nervous that I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And that dear AA member said, "You do not have a problem." I thought he was wrong. I still think he was wrong. And I believe it was that self-same cold, dreary November afternoon when I stood in a living room of a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, where we live now, that I made up my mind that someday, somehow, I would find a way to help families of alcoholics. And by the grace of God, that opportunity came to me because then, you see, I met another group of people. Now, this was a weird group of folks. They were non-alcoholic. I used to say they didn't have a name, but they had quite a few names, some of which I cannot repeat in polite society. But these were non-alcoholic folk who found it vitally necessary to practice the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to preserve their stability and to restore their sanity. These people entertain the same fears as does an alcoholic. These people cultivate the same self-pity, nourish the same resentments, and develop the same personality traits as does the alcoholic. There was only one difference. These people did not have the allergy to booze, and this was the most revolting development of all because this meant that we had to take our punishment standing up, cold sober. And there's not an alcoholic in the world that can do it. Not without help, you can't do it. And neither could we. Now, we were smug enough many years ago to stand by in places like this and say, "Well, after all, those of us who love alcoholics don't show the physical manifestation of the illness," and I'm beginning to wonder. We thought, because you see, now we've got some case histories to refer to. Now, some of us are not that young anymore. And so we're learning in the ranks of Al-Anon that some of our fellows are dying of massive heart attacks. Some of our folk are going into surgery for ulcerated stomachs. Some of our folks are winding up on mental wards of institutions. So we cannot in truth say any longer that we are not affected mentally and physically by the disease of alcoholism. The critical problems that I mentioned are caused by stress. And can you think of anything more stressful than living with an alcoholic, drunk or sober? The kind of stress gets a little different. But you know, you can get pretty excited about sobriety and the good things that sobriety brings to you, like flying across the continent in an airplane and getting on something up in Pittsburgh that looked like a station wagon with wings on it. That's a stress situation. But he landed as smooth as a feather. He did a great job. And I'll try to get up enough courage to go back tomorrow afternoon. if I can't hitchhike to Pittsburgh. Some of these people that I met in this second group seem to have been born with understanding hearts, ladies and gentlemen, and the rest of these people seem to have developed this understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy. And I knew these people, this strange group of people. They could give me courage to face life one day at a time, and they could make my life a little bit better simply because they were there. And in time, of course, they were to be called Al-Anon family groups. Now, you might have discovered that there's a difference between Al-Anon family group members and members of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a difference. There is no quitters in the Al-Anon family groups. There is no quitters. Now, I don't know what happens to the quitters, bless their heart, but they don't make it in Al-Anon. Those of us who love alcoholics, those of us who are members of Al-Anon, never quit hoping. We never quit hoping that that man we married will come home again. And some of you get lost down in a bottle and you can't find your way home to us again. Now, hope burns low at times, but we never quit hoping. And we never quit helping the alcoholic. Now, I have to admit that our methods get a little drastic at times. But we never quit helping the alcoholic. But more important than either of these things, we never quit loving an alcoholic. Never. And it's not fair to those of us who are honorable members of the Al-Anon family groups to classify everyone who lives with an AA member as a member of Al-Anon. This just isn't so. It takes more to be an Al-Anon member than being married to an alcoholic. It takes Al-Anon meetings. It takes an Al-Anon sponsor. And it takes application of these principles to your own life. Just because you're married to an alcoholic does not make you a member of the Al-Anon family groups. And there seems to be a great confusion in the minds of many AA people. Namely, one who's married to your speaker in the morning. He makes a cute remark about those fast-talking alcoholics counting the slow-thinking Al-Anons. I'm going to break his bones one of these days. I want to make another very important point. Back in the late 40s, and they were writing a lot of articles in ladies' magazines about group therapy in the field of mental health. And the first time that I ever heard of a family group, and that's what we called them in Texas before they became Al-Anon family groups, I thought this is what those family groups were, a kind of a group therapy thing. And I wasn't honest enough or courageous enough to admit that I was concerned about my mental health. I rationalized and said I was concerned with my emotional stability, and you have to admit that that sounds a little better. But the fact of the matter is, when I met this group of people, I was totally and completely destitute in all areas of my life. And I know that's a much overused term, but it describes me totally. I was absolutely and totally destitute. I had no faith in God. I did not trust my husband's sobriety, and I could not trust people. I know now, of course, that I believe there was a God. Many things I am, but stupid I am not. But my concept of God was a creator of the universe, if you please. I thought that he changed the seasons and he turned the days into nights and he hung out the stars to make it pretty for us. And then I thought he put a brain in our heads and let us go to hell backward. But I had no concept of a personal contact with God, none at all. I know now, too, of course, that I tried to pray when I was cold and scared and sometimes hungry. And I know now, too, that God heard me. I think that God listens very carefully to the prayers of the beginners, and to the prayers of the alcoholic, because he knows that we do not know the words that prayers are made of, and he also knows that we do not have the courage to speak aloud. So he listens very carefully, and he heard me when all I could say was, "Oh God, oh God." And he understood why I couldn't trust people. People do not deal very kindly to families of alcoholics. A lot better now than it was some 30 years ago, when the disease was more, even more stigmatized than it is now. At least we have enough public information now till our children are not quite so discriminated against in schools, and the dreadful stigma has been slowly and surely erased. But 30 years ago, it was something else. And people did not deal very kindly with families of alcoholics. And so God knew why I couldn't trust people. I couldn't even trust myself. I was not responsible for what I said, and I was not responsible for what I did. And I went to these family group meetings simply because my children were afraid of me, and my Bill was ashamed of me. That's why I went. I did not go there to get my Bill sober. It never crossed my mind. I didn't know if he was ever going to be sober or not. And it really didn't matter that much. But I knew that I had to find the disintegrated pieces of a personality that once was me if I were to rear those four children. And that's why I went to my first meeting. And I listened with tongue in cheek. I heard Jenny used that expression last night. I hadn't heard it in a long time. I listened with tongue in cheek when they spoke of prayer and meditation, because I did not believe them. But they told me that if I would put the principles of the steps of this program into my life, that it would change, and that's what I wanted, because I didn't want my children to be afraid of me, and they were afraid of me with good reason. I punished them unmercifully. They spilled a glass of milk on a white tablecloth, and I insisted on white tablecloths. I want you to know, since the tornado, I don't want a white tablecloth, and I'm never going to get another one. It didn't make sense to me, and I've always been afraid to ask a psychologist about it, but I tried to prove to my own children that I was an aristocrat. It didn't make sense to me, but I did it. They were afraid to bring home their grade cards if they made a C. I would not tolerate an average grade. And so they had a reason to be afraid of me. But I did exactly what that first group of people told me to do. I started working those steps. I started at step number one, and I worked down the steps. I hear people talking about working up the steps now, and I wonder where in the world they're going. Bill Wilson says you work down the steps, and there you will find humility and hopefully serenity and peace of mind. And I used the principles of that program to rear four fine kids. That bunch of O'Neill kids have more degrees than a thermometer. And I used to stand behind podiums. The little girl who was sitting behind me a while ago said, "Has your story changed?" "Yes, dear, my story's changed." I stood behind podiums like this around the country for many years and said, "I'll put those four kids of mine against any in the world." I raised a fine bunch of folk. They got along just fine until they got mixed up with some other folks' kids. I don't mean that to be a funny. We do a dreadful thing to our children that grow up in AA homes. We provide them with a nucleus of protection that the other world, other people in the world do not recognize. And we fail to tell them that everybody in the world is not living by the principles of these 12 steps. And when they step out into the world, they're totally vulnerable and helpless. This is a grave danger I'm mentioning to you. Our kids grew up in an AA home with an Al-Anon mother, and I don't believe there's a one of you that'll say to me, "You only paid lip service to this program, Arbutus." I don't believe you'll say that. I used the principles of this program to raise our children. I'm the most privileged Al-Anon member that you will ever see in your lifetime. And I don't mean that to be a smart aleck. I am the most privileged Al-Anon member you'll ever meet. Because it has been my privilege to watch this fellowship evolve from 50 groups when I came here to the present over 25,000 groups. I was here when Lois wrote the letter to the groups and asked us to pledge ourselves to use the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people say, but we changed the 12th step. No, the AAs changed the 12th step. In the original manuscript of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12th step reads as the Al-Anon steps read. We tried to carry this message to others and practice these principles in all of our affairs. The AAs recognized that they were not equipped to help the whole world, and so they changed the reading of that step to read other alcoholics. This isn't information that I took off the top of my head. It can be documented. I went to New York to the first World Service Conference as a delegate. There was 12 of us there. We were scared to death of the office staff and the board of directors that preceded the board of trustees. They were scared to death of us. They thought we'd make them count the paper clips and account for every sheet of paper they threw in the wastebasket. And we thought that they were going to deliver edicts that we'd have to go back and try to convince the Texans they'd have to live by, and we knew we couldn't do it. But we were a very close group. After 3 years as a delegate, I rotated out of the conference. And I went away with a heavy heart because we'd grown too unwieldy to allow observers anymore, and I didn't think I'd ever be able to go back to a conference. Now, this first 36 delegates were visionaries. We had projected some very ambitious concepts with no hope they would ever be a reality. We were real visionaries. 7 years later, I was 10 years in the program when I was elected delegate, and when I was 20 years in the program, I was elected to serve on the Board of Trustees as the regional trustee for the Western United States. But there was only a 7-year interim there from my last conference as a delegate to my first conference as a trustee. And something had changed in that conference. There weren't 36 delegates anymore. There was upward of 60. And those same ambitious concepts that we had projected were being put into effect as a matter of fact. Nothing to it. The delegates were younger and smarter than the first group. And it was my privilege to see that conference evolve. I can remember when we adopted the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous so that they would fit the needs of families of alcoholics. And it was my privilege to be a part of the development of the 12 concepts of service. You see, ladies and gentlemen, we have never had a 12-step program. We have a three-legacy program given to us by the great generosity of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is registered in the United States Congress of the United States of America under the auspices of Alcoholics Anonymous. You gave it to us freely and with great love because we started using the principles that kept you sober to change our attitudes toward the illness. And as far as I'm concerned, it's one of the greatest demonstrations of ninth step amends I have ever seen in my life. And I want to personally thank you with deepest gratitude for the principles that allowed me to rear a family that any mother in the world would be proud to introduce. It is not a success story for the O'Neills. Bill told you about the health problems that he had had. Four of these lovely children of ours, two of our daughters and our only son, are divorced people. I intended, I know now, to create an environment in that AA home with Al-Anon friends close by. I intended to create an environment that would stop alcoholism in this generation. Alcoholism killed my father. Alcoholism disabled my beloved Bill. And I did not want alcoholism to threaten our children. I have to report at this time that this concept was like a lot of the other fantasies I had. It didn't work. Our son Luther has been in AA for 5 years. He does not have 8 years, 5 years continuous sobriety because he had a slip. Our daughter Nancy, our beautiful red-headed daughter, is going to be sober 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous come September. She lives in Mexico. The complications that alcoholism causes in a psychiatrist's wife's life frightened her so badly that she left the country, and I mean that not so funny. But she lives in Mexico. She goes to meetings in Guadalajara. She lives in the suburb of Guadalajara. She goes to Spanish-speaking meetings and says she can understand about 80% of the meetings. I laughed at her when she came home the last time. She said somebody cut in front of her on the highway down by Marfa, Texas, and she said, "Mother, I cussed him in Spanish." But I want to say this to you, those of you who are parents of people who have alcoholism. It was rough watching Bill almost die of the illness, and he did. I've held that boy in my arms through many long nights when he was in convulsions, not knowing whether he'd live till morning, not knowing if he did live that he'd have any sanity left. I couldn't tell which one of those eyes was the artificial eye because there was no sanity there. And that was hard. That was difficult. But I want you to know it was a piece of cake waiting for that boy of mine. Waiting for that boy of mine. I couldn't do a thing. Knew better. Knew better. Don't do anything. And I almost lived up to that. My AA friends in Austin would occasionally call me and say, "You can go to sleep, Arbutus." We followed Luther home and he turned in his own driveway. But letting him decide, that was tough. But again, that was another piece of cake compared to watching Nancy. I've heard AA women talk about how vulnerable they are when they're drinking. I know about how people exploit women who are blacked out, and I have a very lively imagination. It almost drove me crazy. But I had to wait. I had to wait. And I am so eternally grateful for the fact that I had enough Al-Anon principles behind me that I didn't try to do anything except wait. Just wait. I do not call the people I love alcoholics. I never did like the term referred to when I referred to Bill. I just didn't feel comfortable with it. And I believe it would choke me to death to say my alcoholic son or my alcoholic daughter. And I don't have to. I don't have to at all. My only son has alcoholism, and my beautiful red-headed daughter has alcoholism. And that's the way I can accept it. And that's the way I do accept it. They're not very easy to live with, sober. A Luther's a smart aleck. He occasionally says to me, "Little gray-haired mother, you better wind up your tolerator." Now, you know that's smart aleck. He He knew I was coming to West Virginia, and he said, "Is it going to be very painful for you, Mother?" And I said, "No, the circumstances are different. I know more about alcoholism than I did in 1965, and the circumstances are different. I've talked much too long. You're easy to talk to, and it's hard to relate 33 years in Al-Anon in a few minutes. If I've bored you, I'm sorry. And I want to close now the way I close every talk I ever make. And I want you to remember what I say. The principles of our program carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And we're the only people on earth that are uniquely qualified to carry that message. The only people on earth. In all probability, within a stone's throw of this beautiful camp, there's drunken men and women who will die, not knowing they're alcoholic, if we fail to carry this message. There's men and women, perhaps within a stone's throw of this beautiful camp, who will not have the courage to face life one more day with these very sick people, and they'll break up their homes if we fail to carry this message. And there's kids. There's kids out there, not Alateen members. There's kids out there who are afraid for their dad to come home, or it might be their mother. And these kids will grow up with deformed personalities if we fail to carry this message. And if we fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on these people. And may God have mercy on us. Thank you very much.